Chapter 1. The beginning my early life and character I thirst for adventure in foreign the lands and go to sea. Roving has always been, and still is, my ruling passion, the joy of my heart, the very sunshine of my existence. In childhood, in boyhood, and in man's estate, I have been a rover, not a mere rambler among the woody glens and upon the hilltops of my own native land, but an enthusiastic rover throughout the length and breadth of the wide, wide world. It was a wild, black night of howling storm, the night in which I was born on the foaming bosom of the broad Atlantic Ocean. My father was a sea captain, my grandfather was a sea captain, my great-grandfather had been a marine. Nobody could tell positively what occupation _his_father had followed, but my dear mother used to assert that he had been a midshipman, whose grandfather, on the mother's side, had been an admiral in the Royal Navy. At any rate, we knew that, as far back as our family could be traced, it had been intimately connected with the great watery waste. Indeed, this was the case on both sides of the house, for my mother always went to sea with my father on his long voyages, and so spent the greater part of her life upon the water. Thus it was, I suppose, that I came to inherit a roving disposition. Soon after I was born, my father, being old, retired from a seafaring life, purchased a small cottage in a fishing village on the west coast of England, and settled down to spend the evening of his life on the shores of that sea which had for so many years been his home. It was not long after this that I began to show the roving spirit that dwelt within me. For some time past my infant legs had been gaining strength, so that I came to be dissatisfied with rubbing the skin off my chubby knees by walking on them, and made many attempts to stand up and walk like a man, all of which attempts, however, resulted in my sitting down violently and in sudden surprise. One day I took advantage of my dear mother's absence to make another effort, and, to my joy, I actually succeeded in reaching the doorstep, over which I tumbled into a pool of muddy water that lay before my father's cottage door. Ah, how vividly I remember the horror of my poor mother when she found me sweltering in the mud amongst a group of cackling ducks, and the tenderness with which she stripped off my dripping clothes and washed my dirty little body. From this time forth my rambles became more frequent, and, as I grew older, more distant, until at last I had wandered far and near on the shore and in the woods around our humble dwelling, and did not rest content until my father bound me apprentice to a coasting vessel, and let me go to sea. For some years I was happy in visiting the seaports, and in coasting along the shores of my native land. My Christian name was Ralph, and my comrades added to this the name of Rover, in consequence of the passion which I always evinced for traveling. Rover was not my real name, but as I never received any other I came at last to answer to it as naturally as to my proper name, and, as it is not a bad one, I see no good reason why I should not introduce myself to the reader as Ralph Rover. My shipmates were kind, good-natured fellows, and they and I got on very well together. They did, indeed, very frequently make game of and banter me, but not unkindly, and I overheard them sometimes saying that Ralph Rover was a queer, old-fashioned fellow. This, I must confess, surprised me much, and I pondered the saying long, but could come at no satisfactory conclusion as to that wherein my old-fashionedness lay. It is true I was a quiet lad, and seldom spoke except when spoken to. Moreover, I never could understand the jokes of my companions even when they were explained to me, which dullness and apprehension occasioned me much grief. However, I tried to make up for it by smiling and looking pleased when I observed that they were laughing at some witticism which I had failed to detect. I was also very fond of inquiring into the nature of things and their causes, and often fell into fits of abstraction while thus engaged in my mind. But in all this I saw nothing that did not seem to be exceedingly natural, and could by no means understand why my comrades should call me an old-fashioned fellow. Now, while engaged in the coasting trade, I fell in with many seamen who had traveled to almost every quarter of the globe, and I freely confess that my heart glowed ardently within me as they recounted their wild adventures in foreign lands, the dreadful storms they had weathered, the appalling dangers they had escaped, the wonderful creatures they had seen both on the land and in the sea, and the interesting lands and strange people they had visited. But of all the places of which they told me, none captivated and charmed my imagination so much as the coral islands of the southern seas. They told me of thousands of beautiful fertile islands that had been formed by a small creature called the coral insect, where summer rained nearly all the year round, where the trees were laden with a constant harvest of luxuriant fruit, where the climate was almost perpetually delightful, yet where, strange to say, men were wild, bloodthirsty savages, excepting in those favored isles to which the gospel of our Savior had been conveyed. These exciting accounts had so great an effect upon my mind, that, when I reached the age of 15, I resolved to make a voyage to the South Seas. I had no little difficulty at first in prevailing on my dear parents to let me go, but when I urged on my father that he would never have become a great captain had he remained in the coasting trade, he saw the truth of what I said, and gave his consent. My dear mother, seeing that my father had made up his mind, no longer offered opposition to my wishes. "But oh, Ralph," she said, on the day I bade her adieu, "come back soon to us, my dear boy, for we are getting old now, Ralph, and may not have many years to live." I will not take up my reader's time with a minute account of all that occurred before I took my final leave of my dear parents. Suffice it to say, that my father placed me under the charge of an old messmate of his own, a merchant captain, who was on the point of sailing to the South Seas in his own ship, the Arrow. My mother gave me her blessing and a small Bible, and her last request was, that I would never forget to read a chapter every day, and say my prayers, which I promised, with tears in my eyes, that I would certainly do. Soon afterwards I went on board the Arrow, which was a fine large ship, and set sail for the islands of the Pacific Ocean. Chapter 2. The departure, the seamy companion, some account of the wonderful sights we saw on the great deep, a dreadful storm and a frightful wreck. It was a bright, beautiful, warm day when our ship spread her canvas to the breeze, and sailed for the regions of the south. Oh, how my heart bounded with delight as I listened to the merry chorus of the sailors, while they hauled at the ropes and got in the anchor. The captain shouted, the men ran to obey, the noble ship bent over to the breeze, and the shore gradually faded from my view, while I stood looking on with a kind of feeling that the whole was a delightful dream. The first thing that struck me as being different from anything I had yet seen during my short career on the sea, was the hoisting of the anchor on deck, and lashing it firmly down with ropes, as if we had now bid adieu to the land forever, and would require its services no more. "There, lass," cried a broad-shouldered Jack Tar, giving the fluke of the anchor a hearty slap with his hand after the housing was completed, "there, lass, take a good nap now, for we shan't ask you to kiss the mud again for many a long day to come." And so it was. That anchor did not kiss the mud for many long days afterwards, and when at last it did, it was for the last time. There were a number of boys in the ship, but two of them were my special favorites. Jack Martin was a tall, strapping, broad-shouldered youth of 18, with a handsome, good-humored, firm face. He had had a good education, was clever and hearty and lion-like in his actions, but mild and quiet in disposition. Jack was a general favorite, and had a peculiar fondness for me. My other companion was Peterkengay. He was little, quick, funny, decidedly mischievous, and about 14 years old. But Peterkin's mischief was almost always harmless, else he could not have been so much beloved as he was. "Hello, youngster," cried Jack Martin, giving me a slap on the shoulder, "the day I join the ship, come below and I'll show you your berth. You and I are to be messmates, and I think we shall be good friends, for I like the look of you." Jack was right. He and I and Peterkin afterwards became the best and staunchest friends that ever tossed together on the stormy waves. I shall say a little about the first part of our voyage. We had the usual amount of rough weather and calm, also we saw many strange fish rolling in the sea, and I was greatly delighted one day by seeing a shoal of flying fish dart out of the water and skim through the air about a foot above the surface. They were pursued by dolphins, which feed on them, and one flying fish in its terror flew over the ship, struck on the rigging, and fell upon the deck. Its wings were just fins elongated, and we found that they could never fly far at a time, and never mounted into the air like birds, but skimmed along the surface of the sea. Jack and I had it for dinner, and found it remarkably good. When we approached Cape Horn, at the southern extremity of America, the weather became very cold and stormy, and the sailors began to tell stories about the furious gales and the dangers of that terrible cape. "Cape Horn," said one, "is the most horrible headland I ever doubled. I've sailed round it twice already, and both times the ship was almost blowed out of the water." "And I've been round it once," said another, "and that time the sails were split, and the ropes frozen in the blocks, so that they wouldn't work, and we was all but lost." "And I've been round it five times," cried a third, "and every time was worse than another, the gales was so tremendous." "And I've been round it no times at all," cried Peterkin, with an impudent wink of his eye, "an underscore that underscore time I was blowed inside out." Nevertheless, we passed the dreaded cape without much rough weather, and, in the course of a few weeks afterwards, were sailing gently, before a warm tropical breeze, over the Pacific Ocean. Thus we proceeded on our voyage, sometimes bounding merrily before a fair breeze, at other times floating calmly on the glassy wave and fishing for the curious inhabitants of the deep, all of which, although the sailors thought little of them, were strange, and interesting, and very wonderful to me. At last we came among the coral islands of the Pacific, and I shall never forget the delight with which I gazed, when we chanced to pass one, at the pure, white, dazzling shores, and the verdant palm trees, which looked bright and beautiful in the sunshine. And often did we three long to be landed on one, imagining that we should certainly find perfect happiness there. Our wish was granted sooner than we expected. One night, soon after we entered the tropics, an awful storm burst upon our ship. The first squall of wind carried away two of our masts, and left only the foremast standing. Even this, however, was more than enough, for we did not dare to hoist a rag of sail on it. For 5 days the tempest raged in all its fury. Everything was swept off the decks except one small boat. The steersman was lashed to the wheel, lest he should be washed away, and we all gave ourselves up for lost. The captain said that he had no idea where we were, as we had been blown far out of our course, and we feared much that we might get among the dangerous coral reefs which are so numerous in the Pacific. At daybreak on the sixth morning of the gale we saw land ahead. It was an island encircled by a reef of coral on which the waves broke in fury. There was calm water within this reef, but we could only see one narrow opening into it. For this opening we steered, but, ere we reached it, a tremendous wave broke on our stern, tore the rudder completely off, and left us at the mercy of the winds and waves. "It's all over with us now, lads," said the captain to the men, "get the boat ready to launch, we shall be on the rocks in less than half an hour." The men obeyed in gloomy silence, for they felt that there was little hope of so small a boat living in such a sea. "Come, boys," said Jack Martin, in a grave tone, to me and Peterkin, as we stood on the quarter-deck awaiting our fate, "come, boys, we three shall stick together. You see it is impossible that the little boat can reach the shore, crowded with men. It will be sure to upset, so I mean rather to trust myself to a large oar. I see through the telescope that the ship will strike at the tail of the reef, where the waves break into the quiet water inside. So, if we manage to cling to the oar till it is driven over the breakers, we may perhaps gain the shore. What say you, will you join me?" We gladly agreed to follow Jack, for he inspired us with confidence, although I could perceive, by the sad tone of his voice, that he had little hope, and, indeed, when I looked at the white waves that lashed the reef and boiled against the rocks as if in fury, I felt that there was but a step between us and death. My heart sank within me, but at that moment my thoughts turned to my beloved mother, and I remembered those words, which were among the last that she said to me, "Ralph, my dearest child, always remember in the hour of danger to look to your Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. He alone is both able and willing to save your body and your soul." So I felt much comforted when I thought thereon. The ship was now very near the rocks. The men were ready with the boat, and the captain beside them giving orders, when a tremendous wave came towards us. We three ran towards the bow to lay hold of our oar, and had barely reached it when the wave fell on the deck with a crash like thunder. At the same moment the ship struck, the foremast broke off close to the deck and went over the side, carrying the boat and men along with it. Our oar got entangled with the wreck, and Jack seized an axe to cut it free, but, owing to the motion of the ship, he missed the cordage and struck the axe deep into the oar. Another wave, however, washed it clear of the wreck. We all seized hold of it, and the next instant we were struggling in the wild sea. The last thing I saw was the boat whirling in the surf, and all the sailors tossed into the foaming waves. Then I became insensible. On recovering from my swoon, I found myself lying on a bank of soft grass, under the shelter of an overhanging rock, with Peterkin on his knees by my side, tenderly bathing my temples with water, and endeavoring to stop the blood that flowed from a wound in my forehead. Chapter 3. The Coral Island. Our first cogitations after landing, and the result of them, we conclude that the island is uninhabited. There is a strange and peculiar sensation experienced in recovering from a state of insensibility, which is almost indescribable, a sort of dreamy, confused consciousness, a half-waking, half-sleeping condition, accompanied with a feeling of weariness, which, however, is by no means disagreeable. As I slowly recovered and heard the voice of Peterkin inquiring whether I felt better, I thought that I must have overslept myself, and should be sent to the masthead for being lazy, but before I could leap up in haste, the thought seemed to vanish suddenly away, and I fancied that I must have been ill. Then a balmy breeze fanned my cheek, and I thought of home, and the garden at the back of my father's cottage, with its luxuriant flowers, and the sweet-scented honeysuckle that my dear mother trained so carefully upon the trellised porch. But the roaring of the surf put these delightful thoughts to flight, and I was back again at sea, watching the dolphins and the flying fish, and reefing topsails off the wild and stormy Cape Horn. Gradually the roar of the surf became louder and more distinct. I thought of being wrecked far, far away from my native land, and slowly opened my eyes to meet those of my companion Jack, who, with a look of intense anxiety, was gazing into my face. "Speak to us, my dear Ralph," whispered Jack, tenderly. "Are you better now?" I smiled and looked up, saying, "Better? Why, what do you mean, Jack? I'm quite well." "Then what are you shamming for, and frightening us in this way?" said Peterkin, smiling through his tears, for the poor boy had been really under the impression that I was dying. I now raised myself on my elbow, and putting my hand to my forehead, found that it had been cut pretty severely, and that I had lost a good deal of blood. "Come, come, Ralph," said Jack, pressing me gently backward, "lie down, my boy, you're not right yet. Wet your lips with this water, it's cool and clear as crystal. I got it from a spring close at hand. There now, don't say a word, hold your tongue," said he, seeing me about to speak. "I'll tell you all about it, but you must not utter a syllable till you have rested well."
"Oh, don't stop him from speaking, Jack," said Peterkin, who, now that his fears for my safety were removed, busied himself in erecting a shelter of broken branches in order to protect me from the wind, which, however, was almost unnecessary, for the rock beside which I had been laid completely broke the force of the gale.
"Let him speak, Jack, it's a comfort to hear that he's alive, after lying there stiff and white and sulky for a whole hour, just like an Egyptian mummy. Never saw such a fellow as you are, Ralph, always up to mischief. You've almost knocked out all my teeth and more than half choked me, and now you go shamming dead. It's very wicked of you, indeed it is." While Peterkin ran on in this style, my faculties became quite clear again, and I began to understand my position.
"What do you mean by saying I half choked you, Peterkin?" said I.
"What do I mean? Is English not your mother tongue, or do you want me to repeat it in French, by way of making it clearer? Don't you remember?"
"I remember nothing," said I, interrupting him, "after we were thrown into the sea."
Slowly recovering, p24.jpg.
"Hush, Peterkin," said Jack, "you're exciting Ralph with your nonsense. I'll explain it to you. You recollect that after the ship struck, we three sprang over the bow into the sea? Well, I noticed that the oar struck your head and gave you the cut on the brow, which nearly stunned you, so that you grasped Peterkin round the neck without knowing apparently what you were about. In doing so you pushed the telescope, which you clung to as if it had been your life, against Peterkin's mouth."
"Pushed it against his mouth," interrupted Peterkin, "say crammed it down his throat. Why, there's a distinct mark of the brass rim on the back of my gullet at this moment."
"Well, well, be that as it may," continued Jack, "you clung to him, Ralph, till I feared you really would choke him, but I saw that he had a good hold of the oar, so I exerted myself to the utmost to push you towards the shore, which we luckily reached without much trouble, for the water inside the reef is quite calm."
"But the captain and crew, what of them?" I inquired anxiously.
Jack shook his head.
"Are they lost?"
"No, they are not lost, I hope, but I fear there is not much chance of their being saved. The ship struck at the very tail of the island on which we were cast. When the boat was tossed into the sea it fortunately did not upset, although it shipped a good deal of water, and all the men managed to scramble into it, but before they could get the oars out the gale carried them past the point and away to leeward of the island. After we landed I saw them endeavoring to pull towards us, but as they had only one pair of oars out of the eight that belonged to the boat, and as the wind was blowing right in their teeth, they gradually lost ground. Then I saw them put about and hoist some sort of sail, a blanket, I fancy, for it was too small for the boat, and in half an hour they were out of sight."
"Poor fellows," I murmured sorrowfully.
"But the more I think about it, I've better hope of them," continued Jack, in a more cheerful tone. "You see, Ralph, I've read a great deal about these South Sea islands, and I know that in many places they are scattered about in thousands over the sea, so they're almost sure to fall in with one of them before long."
"I'm sure I hope so," said Peterkin, earnestly. "But what has become of the wreck, Jack? I saw you clambering up the rocks there while I was watching Ralph. Did you say she had gone to pieces?"
"No, she has not gone to pieces, but she has gone to the bottom," replied Jack. "As I said before, she struck on the tail of the island and stove in her bow, but the next breaker swung her clear, and she floated away to leeward. The poor fellows in the boat made a hard struggle to reach her, but long before they came near her she filled and went down. It was after she foundered that I saw them trying to pull to the island."
There went a long silence after Jack ceased speaking, and I have no doubt that each was revolving in his mind our extraordinary position. For my part I cannot say that my reflections were very agreeable. I knew that we were on an island, for Jack had said so,
but whether it was inhabited or not I did not know. If it should be inhabited, I felt certain, from all I had heard of South Sea Islanders, that we should be roasted alive and eaten. If it should turn out to be uninhabited, I fancied that we should be starved to death. Oh! Thought I, if the ship had only stuck on the rocks we might have done pretty well, for we could have obtained provisions from her, and tools to enable us to build a shelter, but now alas! Alas! We are lost. These last words I uttered aloud in my distress. Lost! Ralph! Exclaimed Jack, while a smile overspread his hearty countenance. Saved, you should have said. Your cogitations seem to have taken a wrong road, and led you to a wrong conclusion. Do you know what conclusion underscore I underscore have come to? Said Peterkin. I have made up my mind that it's capital, first rate, the best thing that ever happened to us, and the most splendid prospect that ever lay before three jolly young tars. We've got an island all to ourselves. We'll take possession in the name of the king, we'll go and enter the service of its black inhabitants. Of course we'll rise, naturally, to the top of affairs. White men always do in savage countries. You shall be king, Jack, Ralph, prime minister, and I shall be. The court jester, interrupted Jack. No, retorted Peterkin, I'll have no title at all. I shall merely accept a highly responsible situation under government, for you see, Jack, I'm fond of having an enormous salary and nothing to do. But suppose there are no natives? Then we'll build a charming villa, and plant a lovely garden round it, stuck all full of the most splendiferous tropical flowers, and we'll farm the land, plant, sow, reap, eat, sleep, and be merry. But to be serious, said Jack, assuming a grave expression of countenance, which I observed always had the effect of checking Peterkin's disposition to make fun of everything, we are really in rather an uncomfortable position. If this is a desert island, we shall have to live very much like the wild beasts, for we have not a tool of any kind, not even a knife. Yes, we have underscore that underscore, said Peterkin, fumbling in his trousers pocket, from which he drew forth a small penknife with only one blade, and that was broken. Well, that's better than nothing, but come, said Jack, rising, we are wasting our time in underscore talking underscore instead of underscore doing underscore. You seem well enough to walk now, Ralph, let us see what we have got in our pockets, and then let us climb some hill and ascertain what sort of island we have been cast upon, for, whether good or bad, it seems likely to be our home for some time to come. Chapter 4. We examine into our personal property, and make a happy discovery. Our island described, Jack proves himself to be learned and sagacious above his fellows. Curious discoveries, natural lemonade. We now seated ourselves upon a rock and began to examine into our personal property. When we reached the shore, after being wrecked, my companions had taken off part of their clothes and spread them out in the sun to dry, for, although the gale was raging fiercely, there was not a single cloud in the bright sky. They had also stripped off most part of my wet clothes and spread them also on the rocks. Having resumed our garments, we now searched all our pockets with the utmost care, and laid their contents out on a flat stone before us, and, now that our minds were fully alive to our condition, it was with no little anxiety that we turned our several pockets inside out, in order that nothing might escape us. When all was collected together, we found that our worldly goods consisted of the following articles: - First, a small penknife with a single blade broken off about the middle and very rusty, besides having two or three notches on its edge. Peterkin said of this, with his usual pleasantry, that it would do for a saw as well as a knife, which was a great advantage. Second, an old German silver pencil case without any lead in it. Third, a piece of whipcord about 6 yards long. Fourth, a sailmaker's needle of a small size. Fifth, a ship's telescope, which I happened to have in my hand at the time the ship struck, and which I had clung to firmly all the time I was in the water. Indeed, it was with difficulty that Jack got it out of my grasp when I was lying insensible on the shore. I cannot understand why I kept such a firm hold of this telescope. They say that a drowning man will clutch at a straw. Perhaps it may have been some such feeling in me, for I did not know that it was in my hand at the time we were wrecked. However, we felt some pleasure in having it with us now, although we did not see that it could be of much use to us, as the glass at the small end was broken to pieces. Our sixth article was a brass ring which Jack always wore on his little finger. I never understood why he wore it, for Jack was not vain of his appearance, and did not seem to care for ornaments of any kind. Peterkin said it was in memory of the girl he left behind him. But as he never spoke of this girl to either of us, I am inclined to think that Peterkin was either jesting or mistaken. In addition to these articles, we had a little bit of tinder, and the clothes on our backs. These last were as follows: - Each of us had on a pair of stout canvas trousers, and a pair of sailor's thick shoes. Jack wore a red flannel shirt, a blue jacket, and a red Kilmarnock bonnet or nightcap, besides a pair of worsted socks, and a cotton pocket handkerchief, with 16 portraits of Lord Nelson printed on it, and a Union Jack in the middle. The Turkin had on a striped flannel shirt, which he wore outside his trousers, and belted round his waist, after the manner of a tunic, and a round black straw hat. He had no jacket, having thrown it off just before we were cast into the sea, but this was not of much consequence, as the climate of the island proved to be extremely mild, so much so, indeed, that Jack and I often preferred to go about without our jackets. The Turkin had also a pair of white cotton socks, and a blue handkerchief with white spots all over it. My own costume consisted of a blue flannel shirt, a blue jacket, a black cap, and a pair of worsted socks, besides the shoes and canvas trousers already mentioned. This was all we had, and besides these things we had nothing else, but, when we thought of the danger from which we had escaped, and how much worse off we might have been had the ship struck on the reef during the night, we felt very thankful that we were possessed of so much, although, I must confess, we sometimes wished that we had had a little more. While we were examining these things, and talking about them, Jack suddenly started and exclaimed, "The oar! We have forgotten the oar! What good will that do us?" Said Peterkin, "There's wood enough on the island to make 1,000 oars." "Eh, lad," replied Jack, "but there's a bit of hoop iron at the end of it, and that may be of much use to us." "Very true," said I, "let us go fetch it," and with that we all three rose and hastened down to the beach. I still felt a little weak from loss of blood, so that my companion soon began to leave me behind, but Jack perceived this, and, with his usual considerate good nature, turned back to help me. This was now the first time that I had looked well about me since landing, as the spot where I had been laid was covered with thick bushes which almost hid the country from our view. As we now emerged from among these and walked down the sandy beach together, I cast my eyes about, and, truly, my heart glowed within me and my spirits rose at the beautiful prospect which I beheld on every side. The gale had suddenly died away, just as if it had blown furiously till it dashed our ship upon the rocks, and had nothing more to do after accomplishing that. The island on which we stood was hilly, and covered almost everywhere with the most beautiful and richly colored trees, bushes, and shrubs, none of which I knew the names of at that time, except, indeed, the coconut palms, which I recognized at once from the many pictures that I had seen of them before I left home. A sandy beach of dazzling whiteness lined this bright green shore, and upon it there fell a gentle ripple of the sea. This last astonished me much, for I recollected that at home the sea used to fall in huge billows on the shore long after a storm had subsided. But on casting my glance out to see the cause became apparent. About a mile distant from the shore I saw the great billows of the ocean rolling like a green wall, and falling with a long, loud roar, upon a low coral reef, where they were dashed into white foam and flung up in clouds of spray. This spray sometimes flew exceedingly high, and, every here and there, a beautiful rainbow was formed for a moment among the falling drops. We afterwards found that this coral reef extended quite round the island, and formed a natural breakwater to it. Beyond this the sea rose and tossed violently from the effects of the storm, but between the reef and the shore it was as calm and as smooth as a pond. My heart was filled with more delight than I can express at sight of so many glorious objects, and my thoughts turned suddenly to the contemplation of the Creator of them all. I mention this the more gladly, because at that time, I am ashamed to say, I very seldom thought of my Creator, although I was constantly surrounded by the most beautiful and wonderful of His works. I observed from the expression of my companion's countenance that he too derived much joy from the splendid scenery, which was all the more agreeable to us after our long voyage on the salt sea. There, the breeze was fresh and cold, but here it was delightfully mild, and, when a puff blew off the land, it came laden with the most exquisite perfume that can be imagined. While we thus gazed, we were startled by a loud huzza from Peterkin, and, on looking towards the edge of the sea, we saw him capering and jumping about like a monkey, and ever and anon tugging with all his might at something that lay upon the shore. "What an odd fellow he is, to be sure," said Jack, taking me by the arm and hurrying forward. "Come, let us hasten to see what it is. Here it is, boys, hurrah! Come along." "Just what we want," cried Peterkin, as we drew near, still tugging with all his power. "First rate, just the very ticket." I need scarcely say to my readers that my companion Peterkin was in the habit of using very remarkable and peculiar phrases. And I am free to confess that I did not well understand the meaning of some of them, such, for instance, as the very ticket, but I think it my duty to recount everything relating to my adventures with a strict regard to truthfulness in as far as my memory serves me, so I write, as nearly as possible, the exact words that my companion spoke. I often asked Peterkin to explain what he meant by ticket, but he always answered me by going into fits of laughter. However, by observing the occasions on which he used it, I came to understand that it meant to show that something was remarkably good, or fortunate. On coming up we found that Peterkin was vainly endeavoring to pull the axe out of the oar, into which, it will be remembered, Jack struck it while endeavoring to cut away the cordage among which it had become entangled at the bow of the ship. Fortunately for us the axe had remained fast in the oar, and even now, all Peterkin's strength could not draw it out of the cut. "Ah! That is capital indeed," cried Jack, at the same time giving the axe a wrench that plucked it out of the tough wood. "How fortunate this is! It will be of more value to us than 100 knives, and the edge is quite new and sharp." "I'll answer for the toughness of the handle at any rate," cried Peterkin, "my arms are nearly pulled out of the sockets. But see here, our luck is great. There is iron on the blade." He pointed to a piece of hoop iron, as he spoke, which had been nailed round the blade of the oar to prevent it from splitting. This also was a fortunate discovery. Jack went down on his knees, and with the edge of the axe began carefully to force out the nails. But as they were firmly fixed in, and the operation blunted our axe, we carried the oar up with us to the place where we had left the rest of our things, intending to burn the wood away from the iron at a more convenient time. "Now, lads," said Jack, after we had laid it on the stone which contained our little all, "I propose that we should go to the tail of the island, where the ship struck, which is only a quarter of a mile off, and see if anything else has been thrown ashore. I don't expect anything, but it is well to see. When we get back here it will be time to have our supper and prepare our beds." "Agreed," cried Peterkin and I together, as, indeed, we would have agreed to any proposal that Jack made, for, besides his being older and much stronger and taller than either of us, he was a very clever fellow, and I think would have induced people much older than himself to choose him for their leader, especially if they required to be led on a bold enterprise. Now, as we hastened along the white beach, which shone so brightly in the rays of the setting sun that our eyes were quite dazzled by its glare, it suddenly came into Peterkin's head that we had nothing to eat except the wild berries which grew in profusion at our feet. "What shall we do, Jack?" said he, with a rueful look. "Perhaps they may be poisonous." "No fear," replied Jack, confidently, "I have observed that a few of them are not unlike some of the berries that grow wild on our own native hills. Besides, I saw one or two strange birds eating them just a few minutes ago, and what won't kill the birds won't kill us. But look up there, Peterkin," continued Jack, pointing to the branched head of a coconut palm. "There are nuts for us in all stages." "So there are," cried Peterkin, who being of a very unobservant nature had been too much taken up with other things to notice anything so high above his head as the fruit of a palm tree. But, whatever faults my young comrade had, he could not be blamed for want of activity or animal spirits. Indeed, the nuts had scarcely been pointed out to him when he bounded up the tall stem of the tree like a squirrel, and, in a few minutes, returned with three nuts, each as large as a man's fist. "You had better keep them till we return," raved Jack. "Let us finish our work before eating." "So be it, Captain, go ahead," cried Peterkin, thrusting the nuts into his trousers pocket. "In fact I don't want to eat just now, but I would give a good deal for a drink. Oh that I could find a spring. But I don't see the smallest sign of one hereabouts. I say, Jack, how does it happen that you seem to be up to everything? You have told us the names of half a dozen trees already, and yet you say that you were never in the South Seas before." "I'm not up to underscore everything underscore, Peterkin, as you'll find out ere long," replied Jack, with a smile, "but I have been a great reader of books of travel and adventure all my life, and that has put me up to a good many things that you are, perhaps, not acquainted with." "Oh, Jack, that's all humbug. If you begin to lay everything to the credit of books, I'll quite lose my opinion of you," cried Peterkin, with a look of contempt. "I've seen a lot of fellows that were underscore always underscore poring over books, and when they came to try to underscore do underscore anything, they were no better than baboons." "You are quite right," retorted Jack, "and I have seen a lot of fellows who never looked into books at all, who knew nothing about anything except the things they had actually seen, and very little they knew even about these. Indeed, some were so ignorant that they did not know that coconuts grew on coconut trees." I could not refrain from laughing at this rebuke, for there was much truth in it, as to Peterkin's ignorance. "Humphrey. Maybe you're right," answered Peterkin, "but I would not give underscore tuppence underscore for a man of books, if he had nothing else in him. Neither would I, said Jack, but that's no reason why you should run books down, or think less of me for having read them. Suppose, now, Peterkin, that you wanted to build a ship, and I were to give you a long and particular account of the way to do it, would not that be very useful?
No doubt of it, said Peterkin, laughing.
And suppose I were to write the account in a letter instead of telling you in words, would that be less useful?
Well, no, perhaps not.
Well, suppose I were to print it, and send it to you in the form of a book, would it not be as good and useful as ever?
Oh, bother. Jack, you're a philosopher, and that's worse than anything, cried Peterkin, with a look of pretended horror.
Very well, Peterkin, we shall see, returned Jack, halting under the shade of a coconut tree. You said you were thirsty just a minute ago, now, jump up that tree and bring down a nut, not a ripe one, bring a green, unripe one.
Peterkin looked surprised, but, seeing that Jack was in earnest, he obeyed.
Now, cut a hole in it with your penknife, and clap it to your mouth, old fellow, said Jack. Peterkin did as he was directed, and we both burst into uncontrollable laughter at the changes that instantly passed over his expressive countenance. No sooner had he put the nut to his mouth, and thrown back his head in order to catch what came out of it, then his eyes opened to twice their ordinary size with astonishment, while his throat moved vigorously in the act of swallowing. Then a smile and look of intense delight overspread his face, except, indeed, the mouth, which, being firmly fixed to the hole in the nut, could not take part in the expression, but he endeavored to make up for this by winking at us excessively with his right eye. At length he stopped, and, drawing a long breath, exclaimed,
"Nectar! Perfect nectar! I say, Jack, you're a Brit and the best fellow I ever met in my life. Only taste that," said he, turning to me and holding the nut to my mouth. I immediately drank, and certainly I was much surprised at the delightful liquid that flowed copiously down my throat. It was extremely cool, and had a sweet taste, mingled with acid. In fact, it was the likest thing to lemonade I ever tasted, and was most grateful and refreshing. I handed the nut to Jack, who, after tasting it, said,
"Now, Peterkin, you unbeliever, I never saw or tasted a coconut in my life before, except those sold in shops at home, but I once read that the green nuts contain that stuff, and you see it is true."
"And pray," asked Peterkin, "what sort of stuff does the ripe nut contain?"
"A hollow kernel," answered Jack, "with a liquid like milk in it, but it does not satisfy thirst so well as hunger. It is very wholesome food, I believe."
"Meat and drink on the same tree," cried Peterkin, "washing in the sea, lodging on the ground, and all for nothing. My dear boys, we're set up for life, it must be the ancient paradise, hurrah!" And Peterkin tossed his straw hat in the air, and ran along the beach hallooing like a madman with delight. We afterwards found, however, that these lovely islands were very unlike paradise in many things. But more of this in its proper place. We had now come to the point of rocks on which the ship had struck, but did not find a single article, although we searched carefully among the coral rocks, which at this place jutted out so far as nearly to join the reef that encircled the island. Just as we were about to return, however, we saw something black floating in a little cove that had escaped our observation. Running forward, we drew it from the water, and found it to be a long thick leather boot, such as fishermen at home wear, and a few paces farther on we picked up its fellow. We at once recognized these as having belonged to our captain, for he had worn them during the whole of the storm, in order to guard his legs from the waves and spray that constantly washed over our decks. My first thought on seeing them was that our dear captain had been drowned, but Jack soon put my mind more at rest on that point, by saying that if the captain had been drowned with the boots on, he would certainly have been washed ashore along with them, and that he had no doubt whatever he had kicked them off while in the sea, that he might swim more easily. Peterkin immediately put them on, but they were so large that, as Jack said, they would have done for boots, trousers, and vest too. I also tried them, but, although I was long enough in the legs for them, they were much too large in the feet for me, so we handed them to Jack, who was anxious to make me keep them, but as they fitted his large limbs and feet as if they had been made for him, I would not hear of it, so he consented at last to use them. I may remark, however, that Jack did not use them often, as they were extremely heavy. It was beginning to grow dark when we returned to our encampment, so we put off our visit to the top of a hill till next day, and employed the light that yet remained to us in cutting down a quantity of boughs and the broad leaves of a tree, of which none of us knew the name. With these we erected a sort of rustic bower, in which we meant to pass the night. There was no absolute necessity for this, because the air of our island was so genial and balmy that we could have slept quite well without any shelter,
but we were so little used to sleeping in the open air that we did not quite relish the idea of lying down without any covering over us. Besides, our bower would shelter us from the night dews or rain, if any should happen to fall. Having strewed the floor with leaves and dry grass, we bethought ourselves of supper. But it now occurred to us, for the first time, that we had no means of making a fire. "Now, there's a fix. What shall we do?" said Peterkin, while we both turned our eyes to Jack, to whom we always looked in our difficulties. Jack seemed not a little perplexed. "There are flints enough, no doubt, on the beach," said he, "but they are of no use at all without a steel. However, we must try." So saying, he went to the beach, and soon returned with two flints. On one of these he placed the tinder, and endeavored to ignite it, but it was with great difficulty that a very small spark was struck out of the flints, and the tinder, being a bad, hard piece, would not catch. He then tried the bit of hoop iron, which would not strike fire at all, and after that the back of the axe, with no better success. During all these trials Peterkin sat with his hands in his pockets, gazing with a most melancholy visage at our comrade, his face growing longer and more miserable at each successive failure. "Oh dear," he sighed, "I would not care a button for the cooking of our victuals. Perhaps they don't need it, but it's so dismal to eat one's supper in the dark, and we have had such a capital day, that it's a pity to finish off in this glum style. Oh, I have it," he cried, starting up, "the spyglass, the big glass at the end is a burning glass." "You forget that we have no sun," said I. Peterkin was silent. In his sudden recollection of the telescope he had quite overlooked the absence of the sun. "Ah, boys, I've got it now," exclaimed Jack, rising and cutting a branch from a neighboring bush, which be stripped of its leaves. "I recollect seeing this done once at home. Hand me the bit of whipcord." With the cord and branch Jack soon formed a bow. Then he cut a piece, about 3 inches long, off the end of a dead branch, which he pointed at the two ends. Round this he passed the cord of the bow, and placed one end against his chest, which was protected from its point by a chip of wood. The other point he placed against the bit of tinder, and then began to saw vigorously with the bow, just as a blacksmith does with his drill while boring a hole in a piece of iron. In a few seconds the tinder began to smoke, in less than a minute it caught fire, and in less than a quarter of an hour we were drinking our lemonade and eating coconuts round a fire that would have roasted an entire sheep, while the smoke, flames, and sparks flew up among the broad leaves of the overhanging palm trees, and cast a warm glow upon our leafy bower. That night the starry sky looked down through the gently rustling trees upon our slumbers, and the distant roaring of the surf upon the coral reef was our lullaby. Chapter 5. Morning, and cogitations connected therewith we luxuriate in the sea, try our diving powers, and make enchanting excursions among the coral groves at the bottom of the ocean the wonders of the deep enlarged upon. What a joyful thing it is to awaken, on a fresh glorious morning, and find the rising sun staring into your face with dazzling brilliancy. To see the birds twittering in the bushes, and to hear the murmuring of a rill, or the soft hissing ripples as they fall upon the seashore. At any time and in any place such sights and sounds are most charming, but more especially are they so when one awakens to them, for the first time, in a novel and romantic situation, with the soft sweet air of a tropical climate mingling with the fresh smell of the sea, and stirring the strange leaves that flutter overhead and around one, or ruffling the plumage of the stranger birds that fly inquiringly around, as if to demand what business we have to intrude uninvited on their domains. When I awoke on the morning after the shipwreck, I found myself in this most delightful condition, and, as I lay on my back upon my bed of leaves, gazing up through the branches of the coconut trees into the clear blue sky, and watched the few fleecy clouds that passed slowly across it, my heart expanded more and more with an exulting gladness, the like of which I had never felt before. While I meditated, my thoughts again turned to the great and kind Creator of this beautiful world, as they had done on the previous day, when I first beheld the sea and the coral reef, with the mighty waves dashing over it into the calm waters of the lagoon. While thus meditating, I naturally bethought me of my Bible, for I had faithfully kept the promise, which I gave at parting to my beloved mother, that I would read it every morning, and it was with a feeling of dismay that I remembered I had left it in the ship. I was much troubled about this. However, I consoled myself with reflecting that I could keep the second part of my promise to her, namely, that I should never omit to say my prayers. So I rose quietly, lest I should disturb my companions, who were still asleep, and stepped aside into the bushes for this purpose. On my return I found them still slumbering, so I again lay down to think over our situation. Just at that moment I was attracted by the sight of a very small parrot, which Jack afterwards told me was called a parroquet. It was seated on a twig that overhung Peterkin's head, and I was speedily lost in admiration of its bright green plumage, which was mingled with other gay colors. While I looked, I observed that the bird turned its head slowly from side to side and looked downwards, first with the one eye, and then with the other. On glancing downwards, I observed that Peterkin's mouth was wide open, and that this remarkable bird was looking into it. Peterkin used to say that I had not an atom of fun in my composition, and that I never could understand a joke. In regard to the latter, perhaps he was right, yet I think that, when they were explained to me, I understood jokes as well as most people, but in regard to the former he must certainly have been wrong, for this bird seemed to me to be extremely funny, and I could not help thinking that, if it should happen to faint, or slip its foot, and fall off the twig into Peterkin's mouth, he would perhaps think it funny too. Suddenly the paroquet bent down its head and uttered a loud scream in his face. This awoke him, and, with a cry of surprise, he started up, while the foolish bird flew precipitately away. "Oh, you monster!" cried Peterkin, shaking his fist at the bird. Then he yawned and rubbed his eyes, and asked what o'clock it was. I smiled at this question, and answered that, as our watches were at the bottom of the sea, I could not tell, but it was a little past sunrise. Peterkin now began to remember where we were. As he looked up into the bright sky, and snuffed the scented air, his eyes glistened with delight, and he uttered a faint hurrah, and yawned again. Then he gazed slowly round, till, observing the calm sea through an opening in the bushes, he started suddenly up as if he had received an electric shock, uttered a vehement shout, flung off his garments, and, rushing over the white sands, plunged into the water. The cry awoke Jack, who rose on his elbow with a look of grave surprise, but this was followed by a quiet smile of intelligence on seeing Peterkin in the water. With an energy that he only gave way to in moments of excitement, Jack bounded to his feet, threw off his clothes, shook back his hair, and with a lion-like spring, dashed over the sands and plunged into the sea with such force as quite to envelop Peterkin in a shower of spray. Jack was a remarkably good swimmer and diver, so that after his plunge we saw no sign of him for nearly a minute, after which he suddenly emerged, with a cry of joy, a good many yards out from the shore. My spirits were so much raised by seeing all this that I, too, hastily threw off my garments and endeavored to imitate Jack's vigorous bound, but I was so awkward that my foot caught on a stump, and I fell to the ground. Then I slipped on a stone while running over the mud, and nearly fell again, much to the amusement of Peterkin, who laughed heartily, and called me a slow coach, while Jack cried out, "Come along, Ralph, and I'll help you." However, when I got into the water I managed very well, for I was really a good swimmer, and diver too. I could not, indeed, equal Jack, who was superior to any Englishman I ever saw, but I infinitely surpassed Peterkin, who could only swim a little, and could not dive at all. While Peterkin enjoyed himself in the shallow water and in running along the beach, Jack and I swam out into the deep water, and occasionally dived for stones. I shall never forget my surprise and delight on first beholding the bottom of the sea. As I have before stated, the water within the reef was as calm as a pond, and, as there was no wind, it was quite clear, from the surface to the bottom, so that we could see down easily even at a depth of 20 or 30 yards. When Jack and I dived in shallower water, we expected to have found sand and stones, instead of which we found ourselves in what appeared really to be an enchanted garden. The whole of the bottom of the lagoon, as we called the calm water within the reef, was covered with coral of every shape, size, and hue. Some portions were formed like large mushrooms, others appeared like the brain of a man, having stalks or necks attached to them, but the most common kind was a species of branching coral, and some portions were of a lovely pale pink color, others pure white. Among this there grew large quantities of seaweed of the richest hues imaginable, and of the most graceful forms, while innumerable fishes blue, red, yellow, green, and striped sported in and out amongst the flower beds of this submarine garden, and did not appear to be at all afraid of our approaching them. On darting to the surface for breath, after our first dive, Jack and I rose close to each other. "Did you ever in your life, Ralph, see anything so lovely?" said Jack, as he flung the spray from his hair. "Never," I replied. "It appears to me like fairy realms. I can scarcely believe that we are not dreaming." "Dreaming?" cried Jack. "Do you know, Ralph, I'm half tempted to think that we really are dreaming. But if so, I am resolved to make the most of it, and dream another dive, so here goes, down again, my boy." We took the second dive together, and kept beside each other while underwater, and I was greatly surprised to find that we could keep down much longer than I ever recollect having done in our own seas at home. I believe that this was owing to the heat of the water, which was so warm that we afterwards found we could remain in it for 2 and 3 hours at a time without feeling any unpleasant effects such as we used to experience in the sea at home. When Jack reached the bottom, he grasped the coral stems, and crept along on his hands and knees, peeping under the seaweed and among the rocks. I observed him also pick up 1 or 2 large oysters, and retain them in his grasp, as if he meant to take them up with him, so I also gathered a few. Suddenly he made a grasp at a fish with blue and yellow stripes on its back, and actually touched its tail, but did not catch it. At this he turned towards me and attempted to smile, but no sooner had he done so than he sprang like an arrow to the surface, where, on following him, I found him gasping and coughing, and spitting water from his mouth. In a few minutes he recovered, and we both turned to swim ashore. "I declare, Ralph," said he, "that I actually tried to laugh underwater." "So I saw," I replied, "and I observed that you very nearly caught that fish by the tail. It would have done capitally for breakfast if you had." "Breakfast enough here," said he, holding up the oysters, as we landed and ran up the beach. "Hello. Peterkin, here you are, boy. Split open these fellows while Ralph and I put on our clothes. They'll agree with the coconuts excellently, I have no doubt." Peterkin, who was already dressed, took the oysters, and opened them with the edge of our axe, exclaiming, "Now, that underscore is underscore capital. There's nothing I'm so fond of."
"Ah. That's lucky," remarked Jack. "I'll be able to keep you in good order now, Master Peterkin. You know you can't dive any better than a cat. So, sir, whenever you behave ill, you shall have no oysters for breakfast."
"I'm very glad that our prospect of breakfast is so good," said I, "for I'm very hungry."
"Here, then, stop your mouth with that, Ralph," said Peterkin, holding a large oyster to my lips. I opened my mouth and swallowed it in silence, and really it was remarkably good. We now set ourselves earnestly about our preparations for spending the day. We had no difficulty with the fire this morning, as our burning glass was an admirable one, and while we roasted a few oysters and ate our coconuts, we held a long, animated conversation about our plans for the future. What those plans were, and how we carried them into effect, the reader shall see hereafter. Chapter 6. An excursion into the interior, in which we make many valuable and interesting discoveries. We get a dreadful fright. The breadfruit tree. Wonderful peculiarity of some of the fruit tree signs of former inhabitants. Our first care, after breakfast, was to place the few articles we possessed in the crevice of a rock at the farther end of a small cave which we discovered near our encampment. This cave, we hoped, might be useful to us afterwards as a storehouse. Then we cut 2 large clubs off a species of very hard tree which grew near at hand. One of these was given to Peterkin, the other to me, and Jack armed himself with the axe. We took these precautions because we purposed to make an excursion to the top of the mountains of the interior, in order to obtain a better view of our island. Of course we knew not what dangers might befall us by the way, so thought it best to be prepared. Having completed our arrangements and carefully extinguished our fire, we sallied forth and walked a short distance along the sea beach, till we came to the entrance of a valley, through which flowed the rivulet before mentioned. Here we turned our backs on the sea and struck into the interior. The prospect that burst upon our view on entering the valley was truly splendid. On either side of us there was a gentle rise in the land, which thus formed 2 ridges about a mile apart on each side of the valley. These ridges, which, as well as the low grounds between them, were covered with trees and shrubs of the most luxuriant kind, continued to recede inland for about 2 miles, when they joined the foot of a small mountain. This hill rose rather abruptly from the head of the valley, and was likewise entirely covered even to the top with trees, except on one particular spot near the left shoulder, where was a barren rocky place of a broken and savage character. Beyond this hill we could not see, and we therefore directed our course up the banks of the rivulet towards the foot of it, intending to climb to the top, should that be possible, as, indeed, we had no doubt it was. Jack, being the wisest and boldest among us, took the lead, carrying the axe on his shoulder. Peterkin, with his enormous club, came second, as he said he should like to be in a position to defend me if any danger should threaten. I brought up the rear, but, having been more taken up with the wonderful and curious things I saw at starting than with thoughts of possible danger, I had very foolishly left my club behind me. Although, as I have said, the trees and bushes were very luxuriant, they were not so thickly crowded together as to hinder our progress among them. We were able to wind in and out, and to follow the banks of the stream quite easily, although, it is true, the height and thickness of the foliage prevented us from seeing far ahead.
but sometimes a jutting out rock on the hillsides afforded us a position whence we could enjoy the romantic view and mark our progress towards the foot of the hill. I was particularly struck, during the walk, with the richness of the undergrowth in most places, and recognized many berries and plants that resembled those of my native land, especially a tall, elegantly formed fern, which emitted an agreeable perfume. There were several kinds of flowers, too, but I did not see so many of these as I should have expected in such a climate. We also saw a great variety of small birds of bright plumage, and many paroquets similar to the one that awoke Peterkin so rudely in the morning. Thus we advanced to the foot of the hill without encountering anything to alarm us, except, indeed, once, when we were passing close under a part of the hill which was hidden from our view by the broad leaves of the banana trees, which grew in great luxuriance in that part. Jack was just preparing to force his way through this thicket, when we were startled and arrested by a strange pattering or rumbling sound, which appeared to us quite different from any of the sounds we had heard during the previous part of our walk.
"Hello!" cried Peterkin, stopping short and grasping his club with both hands. "What's that?"
Neither of us replied, but Jack seized his axe in his right hand, while with the other he pushed aside the broad leaves and endeavored to peer amongst them.
"I can see nothing," he said, after a short pause.
"I think it." Again the rumbling sound came, louder than before, and we all sprang back and stood on the defensive. For myself, having forgotten my club, and not having taken the precaution to cut another, I buttoned my jacket, doubled my fists, and threw myself into a boxing attitude. I must say, however, that I felt somewhat uneasy, and my companions afterwards confessed that their thoughts at this moment had been instantly filled with all they had ever heard or read of wild beasts and savages, torturings at the stake, roastings alive, and such like horrible things. Suddenly the pattering noise increased with tenfold violence. It was followed by a fearful crash among the bushes, which was rapidly repeated, as if some gigantic animal were bounding towards us. In another moment an enormous rock came crashing through the shrubbery, followed by a cloud of dust and small stones, flew close past the spot where we stood, carrying bushes and young trees along with it.
"Pooh! Is that all?" exclaimed Peterkin, wiping the perspiration off his forehead.
"Why, I thought it was all the wild men and beasts in the South Sea Islands galloping on in one grand charge to sweep us off the face of the earth, instead of a mere stone tumbling down the mountainside."
"Nevertheless," remarked Jack, "if that same stone had hit any of us, it would have rendered the charge you speak of quite unnecessary, Peterkin."
This was true, and I felt very thankful for our escape. On examining the spot more narrowly, we found that it lay close to the foot of a very rugged precipice, from which stones of various sizes were always tumbling at intervals. Indeed, the numerous fragments lying scattered all around might have suggested the cause of the sound, had we not been too suddenly alarmed to think of anything. We now resumed our journey, resolving that, in our future excursions into the interior, we would be careful to avoid this dangerous precipice. Soon afterwards we arrived at the foot of the hill and prepared to ascend it. Here Jack made a discovery which caused us all very great joy. This was a tree of a remarkably beautiful appearance, which Jack confidently declared to be the celebrated breadfruit tree.
"Is it celebrated?" inquired Peterkin, with a look of great simplicity.
"It is," replied Jack.
"That's odd, now," rejoined Peterkin. "Never heard of it before."
"Then it's not so celebrated as I thought it was," returned Jack, quietly squeezing Peterkin's hat over his eyes. "But listen, you ignorant booby. And hear of it now."
Peterkin readjusted his hat, and was soon listening with as much interest as myself, while Jack told us that this tree is one of the most valuable in the islands of the South, that it bears two, sometimes three, crops of fruit in the year, that the fruit is very like wheaten bread in appearance, and that it constitutes the principal food of many of the islanders.
"So," said Peterkin, "we seem to have everything ready prepared to our hands in this wonderful island, lemonade ready bottled in nuts, and loaf bread growing on the trees."
Peterkin, as usual, was jesting. Nevertheless, it is a curious fact that he spoke almost the literal truth.
"Moreover," continued Jack, "the breadfruit tree affords a capital gum, which serves the natives for pitching their canoes. The bark of the young branches is made by them into cloth, and of the wood, which is durable and of a good color, they build their houses. So you see, lads, that we have no lack of material here to make us comfortable, if we are only clever enough to use it."
"But are you sure that that's it?" asked Peterkin.
"Quite sure," replied Jack, "for I was particularly interested in the account I once read of it, and I remember the description well. I am sorry, however, that I have forgotten the descriptions of many other trees which I am sure we have seen today, if we could but recognize them. So you see,
Peterkin, I'm not up to everything yet.
Never mind, Jack, said Peterkin, with a grave, patronizing expression of countenance, patting his tall companion on the shoulder. Never mind, Jack, you know a good deal for your age. You're a clever boy, sir, a promising young man, and if you only go on as you have begun, sir, you will.
The end of this speech was suddenly cut short by Jack tripping up Peterkin's heels and tumbling him into a mass of thick shrubs, where, finding himself comfortable, he lay still basking in the sunshine, while Jack and I examined the bread tree. We were much struck with the deep, rich green color of its broad leaves, which were 12 or 18 inches long, deeply indented, and of a glossy smoothness, like the laurel. The fruit, with which it was loaded, was nearly round, and appeared to be about 6 inches in diameter, with a rough rind, marked with lozenge-shaped divisions. It was of various colors, from light pea-green to brown and rich yellow. Jack said that the yellow was the ripe fruit. We afterwards found that most of the fruit trees on the island were evergreens, and that we might, when we wished, pluck the blossom and the ripe fruit from the same tree. Such a wonderful difference from the trees of our own country surprised us not a little. The bark of the tree was rough and light-colored, the trunk was about 2 feet in diameter, and it appeared to be 20 feet high, being quite destitute of branches up to that height, where it branched off into a beautiful and umbrageous head. We noticed that the fruit hung in clusters of twos and threes on the branches, but as we were anxious to get to the top of the hill, we refrained from attempting to pluck any at that time. Our hearts were now very much cheered by our good fortune, and it was with light and active steps that we clambered up the steep sides of the hill. On reaching the summit, a new, and if possible a grander, prospect met our gaze. We found that this was not the highest part of the island, but that another hill lay beyond, with a wide valley between it and the one on which we stood. This valley, like the first, was also full of rich trees, some dark and some light green, some heavy and thick in foliage, and others light, feathery, and graceful, while the beautiful blossoms on many of them threw a sort of rainbow tint over all, and gave to the valley the appearance of a garden of flowers. Among these we recognized many of the breadfruit trees, laden with yellow fruit, and also a great many coconut palms. After gazing our fill we pushed down the hillside, crossed the valley, and soon began to ascend the second mountain. It was clothed with trees nearly to the top, but the summit was bare, and in some places broken. While on our way up we came to an object which filled us with much interest. This was the stump of a tree that had evidently been cut down with an axe. So, then, we were not the first who had viewed this beautiful isle. The hand of man had been at work there before us. It now began to recur to us again that perhaps the island was inhabited, although we had not seen any traces of man until now, but a second glance at the stump convinced us that we had not more reason to think so now than formerly, for the surface of the wood was quite decayed, and partly covered with fungus and green matter, so that it must have been cut many years ago. Perhaps, said Peterkin, some ship or other has touched here long ago for wood, and only taken one tree. We did not think this likely, however, because, in such circumstances, the crew of a ship would cut wood of small size, and near the shore, whereas this was a large tree and stood near the top of the mountain. In fact it was the highest large tree on the mountain, all above it being wood of very recent growth. I can't understand it, said Jack, scratching the surface of the stump with his axe. I can only suppose that the savages have been here and cut it for some purpose known only to themselves. But, hello! What have we here? As he spoke, Jack began carefully to scrape away the moss and fungus from the stump, and soon laid bare three distinct traces of marks, as if some inscription or initials had been cut thereon. But although the traces were distinct, beyond all doubt, the exact form of the letters could not be made out. Jack thought they looked like J.S. but we could not be certain. They had apparently been carelessly cut, and long exposure to the weather had so broken them up that we could not make out what they were. We were exceedingly perplexed at this discovery, and stayed a long time at the place conjecturing what these marks could have been, but without avail, so, as the day was advancing, we left it and quickly reached the top of the mountain. We found this to be the highest point of the island, and from it we saw our kingdom lying, as it were, like a map around us. As I have always thought it impossible to get a thing properly into one's understanding without comprehending it, I shall beg the reader's patience for a little while and describe our island, thus, shortly, dash. It consisted of two mountains, the one we guessed at 500 feet, the other, on which we stood, at 1,000. Between these lay a rich, beautiful valley, as already said. This valley crossed the island from one end to the other, being high in the middle and sloping on each side towards the sea. The large mountain sloped, on the side farthest from where we had been wrecked, gradually towards the sea, but although, when viewed at a glance, it had thus a regular sloping appearance, a more careful observation showed that it was broken up into a multitude of very small vales, or rather dells and glens, intermingled with little rugged spots and small but abrupt precipices here and there, with rivulets tumbling over their edges and wandering down the slopes in little white streams, sometimes glistening among the broad leaves of the breadfruit and cocoa nut trees, or hid altogether beneath the rich underwood. At the base of this mountain lay a narrow bright green plain or meadow, which terminated abruptly at the shore. On the other side of the island, whence we had come, stood the smaller hill, at the foot of which diverged three valleys, one being that which we had ascended, with a smaller vale on each side of it, and separated from it by the two ridges before mentioned. In these smaller valleys there were no streams, but they were clothed with the same luxuriant vegetation. The diameter of the island seemed to be about 10 miles, and, as it was almost circular in form, its circumference must have been 30 miles, perhaps a little more, if allowance be made for the numerous bays and indentations of the shore. The entire island was belted by a beach of pure white sand, on which laved the gentle ripples of the lagoon. We now also observed that the coral reef completely encircled the island, but it varied its distance from it here and there, in some places being a mile from the beach, in others, a few hundred yards, but the average distance was half a mile. The reef lay very low, and the spray of the surf broke quite over it in many places. This surf never ceased its roar, for, however calm the weather might be, there is always a gentle swaying motion in the great Pacific, which, although scarce noticeable out at sea, reaches the shore at last in a huge billow. The water within the lagoon, as before said, was perfectly still. There were three narrow openings in the reef, one opposite each end of the valley which I have described as crossing the island, the other opposite our own valley, which we afterwards named the Valley of the Wreck. At each of these openings the reef rose into two small green islets, covered with bushes and having one or two coconut palms on each. These islets were very singular, and appeared as if planted expressly for the purpose of marking the channel into the lagoon. Our captain was making for one of these openings the day we were wrecked, and would have reached it too, I doubt not, had not the rudder been torn away. Within the lagoon were several pretty, low coral islands, just opposite our encampment, and, immediately beyond these, out at sea, lay about a dozen other islands, at various distances, from half a mile to 10 miles, all of them, as far as we could discern, smaller than ours and apparently uninhabited. They seemed to be low coral islands, raised but little above the sea, yet covered with coconut trees. All this we noted, and a great deal more, while we sat on the top of the mountain. After we had satisfied ourselves we prepared to return, but here again we discovered traces of the presence of man. These were a pole or staff and one or two pieces of wood which had been squared with an axe. All of these were, however, very much decayed, and they had evidently not been touched for many years. Full of these discoveries we returned to our encampment. On the way we fell in with the traces of some four-footed animal, but whether old or of recent date none of us were able to guess. This also tended to raise our hopes of obtaining some animal food on the island, so we reached home in good spirits, quite prepared for supper, and highly satisfied with our excursion. After much discussion, in which Peterkin took the lead, we came to the conclusion that the island was uninhabited, and went to bed. Chapter 7. Jack's ingenuity. We get into difficulties about fishing, and get out of them by a method which gives us a cold bath. Horrible encounter with a shark. For several days after the excursion related in the last chapter we did not wander far from our encampment, but gave ourselves up to forming plans for the future and making our present abode comfortable. There were various causes that induced this state of comparative inaction. In the first place, although everything around us was so delightful, and we could without difficulty obtain all that we required for our bodily comfort, we did not quite like the idea of settling down here for the rest of our lives, far away from our friends in our native land. To set energetically about preparations for a permanent residence seemed so like making up our minds to saying adieu to home and friends forever, that we tacitly shrank from it and put off our preparations, for one reason and another, as long as we could. Then there was a little uncertainty still as to there being natives on the island, and we entertained a kind of faint hope that a ship might come and take us off. But as day after day passed, and neither savages nor ships appeared, we gave up all hope of an early deliverance and set diligently to work at our homestead. During this time, however, we had not been altogether idle. We made several experiments in cooking the coconut, most of which did not improve it. Then we removed our goods, and took up our abode in the cave, but found the change so bad that we returned gladly to the bower. Besides this we bathed very frequently, and talked a great deal, at least Jack and Peterkin did, I listened. Among other useful things, Jack, who was ever the most active and diligent, converted about 3 inches of the hoop iron into an excellent knife. First he beat it quite flat with the axe. Then he made a rude handle, and tied the hoop iron to it with our piece of whipcord, and ground it to an edge on a piece of sandstone. When it was finished he used it to shape a better handle, to which he fixed it with a strip of his cotton handkerchief, in which operation he had, as Peterkin pointed out, torn off one of Lord Nelson's noses. However, the whipcord, thus set free, was used by Peterkin as a fishing line. He merely tied a piece of oyster to the end of it. This the fish were allowed to swallow, and then they were pulled quickly ashore. But as the line was very short and we had no boat, the fish we caught were exceedingly small. One day Peterkin came up from the beach, where he had been angling, and said in a very cross tone, "I'll tell you what, Jack, I'm not going to be humbugged with catching such contemptible things any longer. I want you to swim out with me on your back, and let me fish in deep water."
"Dear me, Peterkin," replied Jack, "I had no idea you were taking the thing so much to heart, else I would have got you out of that difficulty long ago. Let me see," and Jack looked down at a piece of timber on which he had been laboring, with a peculiar gaze of abstraction, which he always assumed when trying to invent or discover anything. "What say you to building a boat?" he inquired, looking up hastily.
"Take far too long," was the reply, "can't be bothered waiting. I want to begin at once." Again Jack considered. "I have it," he cried. "We'll fell a large tree and launch the trunk of it in the water, so that when you want to fish you've nothing to do but to swim out to it."
"Would not a small raft do better?" said I.
"Much better, but we have no ropes to bind it together with. Perhaps we may find something hereafter that will do as well, but, in the meantime, let us try the tree." This was agreed on, so we started off to a spot not far distant, where we knew of a tree that would suit us, which grew near the water's edge. As soon as we reached it Jack threw off his coat, and, wielding the axe with his sturdy arms, hacked and hewed at it for a quarter of an hour without stopping. Then he paused, and, while he sat down to rest, I continued the work. Then Peterkin made a vigorous attack on it, so that when Jack renewed his powerful blows, a few minutes' cutting brought it down with a terrible crash.
"Hurrah! Now for it," cried Jack, "let us off with its head." So saying he began to cut through the stem again, at about 6 yards from the thick end. This done, he cut 3 strong, short poles or levers from the stout branches, with which to roll the log down the beach into the sea, for, as it was nearly 2 feet thick at the large end, we could not move it without such helps. With the levers, however, we rolled it slowly into the sea. Having been thus successful in launching our vessel, we next shaped the levers into root oars or paddles, and then attempted to embark. This was easy enough to do, but, after seating ourselves astride the log, it was with the utmost difficulty we kept it from rolling round and plunging us into the water. Not that we minded that much, but we preferred, if possible, to fish in dry clothes. To be sure, our trousers were necessarily wet, as our legs were dangling in the water on each side of the log, but, as they could be easily dried, we did not care. After half an hour's practice, we became expert enough to keep our balance pretty steadily. Then Peterkin laid down his paddle, and having baited his line with a whole oyster, dropped it into deep water.
"Now, then, Jack," said he, "be cautious, steer clear of that seaweed. There, that's it, gently, now, gently. I see a fellow at least a foot long down there, coming to ha. That's it. Oh, bother, he's off."
"Did he bite?" said Jack, urging the log onwards a little with his paddle.
"Bite? Eh? He took it into his mouth, but the moment I began to haul he opened his jaws and let it out again. Let him swallow it next time,